Accession number 8736, rule number 15.
Lord Harding, take 15. Lord Harding, could I now ask you about your experience in the Western Desert? You did explain a little while beforehand that you went to Cairo to work on this plan, which was then being prepared with great secrecy.
Well, I went to Cairo rarely. I went to the Middle East rarely with three other officers. We were told that we had to be the staff, the nucleus staff of a division. And when we arrived in Cairo, we found that there was no division at all. We reported to supposed General Gamba Parry, who was in hospital, and he said, "Well, I'm sorry, boys, but it's all rather bogus. There is no division." And it turned out that Archie Wavell had, what he'd done is he'd asked the War Office to provide a nucleus staff, that's a G1, a G2, an AQ, and a DAQ, as a reserve of staff officers. And that's what we were. And so when we arrived in Cairo, we were rather in a limbo. And I was, first of all, put on to do a staff study. I knew Jock Whiteley was then the BGS operations at GHQ in Cairo, whom I knew very well. And I think, to start with, I was put on to do a staff study of a project which had been suggested by Ord Wingate, who was in Cairo at the time, that instead of flogging across the Western Desert, the way to deal with the Italians in Libya and so on, was by an operation based on Nigeria, up through the Tibesti Mountains and into Tripoli that way. And I was told to do a staff study of this, and I did that, and I came to the conclusion that if we had a couple of hundred transport aircraft and the same number of cross-country 10-tonners, it was a feasible operation. Without that, it wasn't. And so I went along to Arthur Smith, who was then the chief of staff, and told him my report, and he said, "Well, you better tell the commander-in-chief." So I was ushered in to Wavell, who listened to what I had to say, and then said, "Well, I see, perhaps I better rely on the long-range desert group." So that was that. And then the next thing, I'm not sure if I got my orders right, I was told that I was to go to Crete to do a staff study there of setting it up as a base for operations in Eastern Europe, Southeast Europe. And fortunately, that was overtaken. And then what happened was that Sandy Galloway, who'd been a colleague and a friend of mine at the Staff College, was BGS of British troops in Egypt. And he fell sick from malaria, and I was told to go temporarily and take over responsibility for his job. And that coincided with the preparation of plans for the operation in the Western Desert against the Italians, which was led by Dick O'Connor. And so I came in on the ground floor, so to speak, on those plans. And then Sandy Galloway came back, came out of hospital and took over, and I was told to go and be a senior liaison officer between Dick O'Connor and Jumbo Wilson, who was then commanding BTE. And so I went out to the desert and joined up with Dick O'Connor in his headquarters. I was with him during the early stages of the campaign. And then I'd known him very well. He'd been a teacher at the Staff College when I was a student there, so I knew him. He knew me very well. And I don't think he was all that pleased, satisfied with his BGS operations. And so I'd spent a great deal of time with him up and down in the desert. And he asked for me to take over at BGS. And I remember rather vividly, Archie Wavell came up to his headquarters, and Dick O'Connor told him he'd like me to take over, and Archie Wavell went back, and his staff apparently then said that I was too young or too junior or something. I can't remember the precise reasons. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was appointed at BGS, Western Desert Force, as it was then called, under General Dick O'Connor, for the final stages of that campaign. And I had a hand in the detailed planning of what is now called the Battle of Sidi Barrani, and then the subsequent advance to Mardia, to Brook, and eventually to across the border. And so I was in on that operation from the very beginning.
Could you tell us something about the plans for Sidi Barrani?
Yes, the Italians had invaded Egypt. It crossed the wire, the boundary between Libya and Egypt, and they'd established themselves in a ring of defensive camps between the wire and the coast at Sidi Barrani. And they were static defensive camps. They were not within close supporting distance of each other, and they were absolutely static. They were defensive. And Dick O'Connor's plan was to, by a night march, to move behind the three eastern camps and attack them in turn from the rear. It was a very risky and imaginative plan and operation, and it involved a longish night march and then a switch of direction, and gradually, successively, in turn, attacking these various camps. I can't remember what they were called now, but there were three or four of them between what we subsequently called Piccadilly Circus, I think, and the coast. And the forces available were the 7th Armored Division, the 4th Indian Division, and the 4th, yes, and that, and an independent brigade, I think. And the plan was that the 7th Armored Division would move out and cover the operations by preventing any interference from the Italians to further west, between the Ember and the wire. While the 4th Indian Division, with the Army Tank Red Battalion and its supporting artillery, successively attacked these posts from the west, where they were facing east, and so the decisive factor in the operation, of course, the decisive element, I think, was the Army Tank Brigade. Well, I think they were Valentine tanks in those days, and they were heavy tanks, heavy infantry tanks they were called, and they were slow, but they were very effective. And successively, they attacked each camp with the 4th Indian Division, who were, of course, very, very well, highly trained and regular division of Indian and British troops. I mean, each infantry brigade had three Indian battalions and one British battalion, so I remember rightly the organization. And they were all under the command of Beresford Pierce, who had a G1 called Rees, who was a very, very highly qualified and intelligent staff officer. And the whole thing was extremely well organized, well done, and carried out with immense success. And it finished up eventually with the Italians being completely mopped up between Ember and the coast, including Siliberani. And then the next stage was to turn westward and clear up the other camps and forts, which were done. Actually, the one, I think, was the Tazard, who had rather serious, heavy casualties in the operation at Bukbuk. But eventually, the whole of the Italian army was cleared, was mopped up. It was a very large number of prisoners. Guns, tanks, vehicles, and so on were taken. And the road was cleared to Bardia, which was the next defensive position which the Italians had taken up, which was inside Libya.
This really would have been the first offensive in that area. Am I right in thinking that? The first offensive.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was. It was started off, originally it started off as a limited exercise. And a limited operation to drive the Italians out of Egypt, and to and then without any further commitments. But it was so successful that I think under Dick O'Connor's initiative, Wavell agreed to it is being continued into Tripoli, or into Libya rather, not Tripoli, into Libya. And so the next phase was to isolate the fortress of Bardia and then attack that.
Before I go on to that, could I ask you a little more about this first phase, you know, the Siliberani? Mm. You mentioned earlier the great secrecy. Was that very important in the success?
Extremely important, yes, because the planning, you see, was done in Cairo. With headquarters, British troops in Egypt, which was then commanded by Jumbo Wilson. And it was of the greatest importance because Egypt was full of spies and rumors and goodness knows what. And so, people were very inclined to gossip in the bars, in Shepherd's, or so on. And so, absolute secrecy was a vital point, and this was achieved by nothing being put on paper or typed on paper, and anything that was put on paper was done in manuscript. And Dick O'Connor, in particular, was extremely determined and absolutely rigid about this, and it was, I'm sure it was a decisive factor.
Alongside the secrecy, did you have good intelligence on the Italian whereabouts?
Well, yes, I think we had. The Italians, of course, had established themselves in these static positions. They didn't really do any patrolling between them, and then they were purely defensive. And the I think it was probably a support group of the 7th Armored Division who carried out most of the patrols and gained all the information about the precise location of the camps. We had very little air reconnaissance at the time. We had one air cooperation squadron, which was excellent and very good, but I don't remember, there may have been, I don't remember any available photographs, but there may have been.
Did you have many problems once you started to advance? You know, obviously, as you have explained, this was much quicker than anticipated with your supply lines.
Oh, yes, very serious. Yes, so that was, I mean, after the initial operation, which was, you know, successful in clearing up and capturing the Italian defensive, well, destroying the Italian defensive position, well, then the administrative problem became very acute, particularly with water and petrol. And at that time, all the petrol supplies were in cans. We hadn't got what the Germans introduced later, was jerry cans. which were able to be transported carefully, but an enormous amount of petrol was lost in the dogging about, the rattling about in lorries and so on. Oh yes, food and water and petrol were extremely difficult problems. A chap called Aaron Nares was the senior administrative officer, and I know he had many, many headaches in making certain that supplies were maintained. And the further west we went, of course, the more acute the problem became.
Did you learn much from that first offensive? Because, after all, this was the first all-out attack, wasn't it, in the desert?
Well, I think so, yes. I think probably as far as I, looking back on it all, I think as far as I personally was concerned, I learned the, endorsed the tremendous importance of good, sound administrative arrangements in support of an offensive. The use of tanks in conjunction with artillery and infantry to attack enemy defensive positions, and the fact that the desert was not an insuperable obstacle to movement.
How did you cope with the prisoners? I imagine you took vast numbers of Italian prisoners.
Well, very, very large numbers. I don't remember personally being involved much with that, but I remember seeing columns of them marching along. I think that was Ernest's problem, to try to reset up, set up prisoners of war camps and so on. But you see, they were pretty docile, really. We didn't have much trouble guarding them or anything like that. I mean, I would say, again, looking back on it all, that they rather exemplified what his name wrote later in his book, what was it called?
Private Angelo.
Eric Linklater wrote a book called Private Angelo, which dealt with an Italian soldier, but this in Italy at a later stage. But I think perhaps the Italian troops, and some of them, I'm talking now about the rest of the campaign, some of them, their artillery and some of the Bersaglieri, fought stubbornly. But for the great many, I don't think their heart was in the fight. And they rather followed the lines of what, whatever his name was, wrote about in his book about Belisarius, that the Italian has no stomach for a fight in spite of all his bluster and boasting. I don't want to malign them or anything like that, because some of them fought very stubbornly and well. But by and large, I don't think they were either well-led, well-equipped, or well-trained. And as said, I don't think their heart was in the job.
Before I go on to the other campaigns in the Western Desert, could I ask you a little more about this job you had as liaison officer between Wavell, Wilson and O'Connor? Any sort of special problems
there? No, I don't know. I don't think Wavell really came into it. I was due to report between O'Connor and Wilson's headquarters. Actually, I got absolved, of course, with Dick O'Connor in the actual campaign, and I don't think I'd paid more than one visit back to Cairo during that period. But I don't think it made much difference. But actually, I was doing, occupied more with acting as chief of staff to O'Connor than I was with being a liaison officer.
Did you have a great deal to do with that planning?
No, I don't think I had a great deal to do with the planning, no. No, I don't think so, not an awful lot. It was really, I mean, the inspiring genius of that campaign with Dick O'Connor And he was the moving spirit in the whole thing. And I don't think myself that sufficient credit has ever been given to him for it part. Actually, when Corelli Barnett wrote his book about it called The Desert General, he wrote to me and asked me if I would answer a questionnaire. I said, no, I don't answer questionnaires, but I'll talk to you about it. And I did have a long talk to him about it, and I was primarily concerned with making sure that he understood the crucial part that General Dick O'Connor played in that total campaign. And that is reflected in his chapters about the original campaign. And to illustrate my point, I remember after the campaign was over, when we were south of Benghazi, I was talking to Frank Berriman, who was the G1 of the 6th Australian Division, who came in and took on from the 14th Division at Bardia and subsequently. I was talking to him, and he said to me one day, he said, "You know what we call your general?" I said, "That's Dick O'Connor." I said, "No." He said, "Well, we call him, he was short, small, and had grey hair." And he said, "We call him the little white-haired terrier because he never lets go." And that's the type of man he was. And it was a tragedy, of course, that he was later captured and took no further part in the war until actually the landing in Normandy.
Yes, I must ask you about that later on. So what were you actually doing then for Sidi Barani? Were you more concerned with logistics, would you say?
Well, I was concerned with the detailed planning of the actual campaign. I mean, Dick O'Connor, one of his great attributes was that he was always a step ahead. He's always in front of the enemy. Ahead in his thinking and in his planning. And, for example, I issued the orders for the advance and the encirclement of Bardia before the campaign of Sidi Barani was over, and similarly from Bardia to Tobruk. And the whole thing was planned and ready to be put into effect on the issue of a code word. He was always, in his thinking, in his planning, he was always at least one step, and sometimes two, ahead of the enemy. But after we'd cleared up the Italians west of the Wire, I talk about the Wire meaning the frontier between Egypt and Libya, because it was a continuous wire fence along there. After we'd done that, then the 4th Indian Division was withdrawn. To our horror and surprise, it was withdrawn from Sidi Barani to go down to Abyssinia. And that was a tremendous blow and shock. Dick O'Connor appealed about it, of course, when the 6th Australian Division was sent up in replacement. Well, they were a division that had been moved from Australia to the Middle East and were in reserve. I think they were back in the Bagal Arab area beforehand, and they'd been training there. And they came up. they were a very fine lot of troops. Very, very good lot of troops. I mean, the Australians are excellent, brilliant fighters. But they were short of artillery in some ways. They had no medium artillery, although we did have a medium regiment. But they were very well led, General Mackay, and they had a regular staff college trained staff. Unfortunately for me, I had known the G1 before. He was a year senior to me at the staff college, a chap called Frank Berriman. And so I had a personal contact there, and I did know them very well, got to know them even better. And they were a very fine division. And they took over and replaced the 4th Indian Division, and they were responsible for the attack on Bandia and then the subsequent advance to Benghazi, supported by, on the left flank, by the 7th Army Division. I can't remember precisely when the changeover took place, but there was no, the thing flowed, there was no big delay between the departure of the 4th Indian Division and the arrival of 6th Australian Division. And so the operation was never damaged by lack of momentum, which was marvelous, really, and very, very good. So that we were able to follow on from Sidi Barani to Bandia and invest that fortress. But again, the Italians were entirely defensive. There was very little patrolling, and they certainly sat tight inside their defenses. And so the planning of the attack on Bandia was done primarily by the 6th Australian Division, and was entirely successful. One rather amusing incident happened. I think, I can't remember his name now, one of the Australian brigade commanders is reported to whose troops were on the northern part of the Bandia front and had penetrated it and collected a lot of Italian prisoners. And one batch of Italian prisoners came to surrender and were told by the brigadier, "Go away, we haven't got time to deal with you, come back in the morning," which they did. The Italian, you see, the Italian posture was entirely defensive. And that made our task all that easier. And then from Bandia, well, before Bandia finally being cleared up, I had issued the orders for the advance to Tobruk and the investment of Tobruk, and then the troops, the 6th Australian Division, and of course the Army Tank Brigade, the Army Tank Battalion Regiment. Matildas they were. They had suffered some losses at Bandia, but they still had enough to carry out the attack on Tobruk. And their maintenance was marvellous. They were commanded by a chap called Roy Jerram, who was very, very good indeed. And each time, after each operation that they had casualties and lost certain tanks, they got busy immediately on their repair and maintenance. And eventually, I think, when we finished up at Makili, with about half a dozen tanks, but they were still functioning.